165. The Election of the 12 Apostles. May the 16th, 1945. It is dawning, and the soft light whitens the mountains, and seems to soften the wild mountainside. Only the gurgling sound of the foamy stream at the bottom of the valley can be heard, a sound which becomes a strange noise, when echoed by the mountain and its many caves. Where the disciples have rested, there is some gentle rustling among the leaves and the herbs. The first birds to awake, or the last night birds returning to their hiding places. A group of hares or wild rabbits, gnawing at a low bush of blackberries, run away frightened by a falling stone. Then they go back cautiously, moving their ears in all directions to pick up every sound, and when they see that everything is peaceful, they return to the bush. All the leaves and stones are wet with dew, and in the woods there is a strong smell of moss, mint, and marjoram. A redbreast flies down to the edge of a cave, the roof of which is formed by a huge protruding stone, and standing up straight on its very thin legs, ready to fly away, it moves its little head round, looks into the cave, and at the ground, chirping inquisitively and gluttonously, because of some breadcrumbs on the ground. But it does not make up its mind to fly down until it sees that it has been preceded by a big blackbird, which proceeds hopping sideways, and is extremely comical in its urchin-like attitude with its profile of an old notary, who wants only a pair of spectacles, to be the complete dignitary. The robin then flies down, hopping behind its daring fellow creature, which now and again thrusts its yellow beak into the moist ground, in archaeological research for food, and then proceeds further, after whistling, just like a real little rascal. The redbreast stuffs itself with the little breadcrumbs, and is amazed when it sees the blackbird, which had confidently gone into the silent cave, come out of it with a cheese rind, which it knocks repeatedly against a stone to break it up, and make a sumptuous meal of it. It goes back in again, has a look round, and not finding anything else, it whistles scoffingly, and flies away to complete its song on the top of an oak tree, in the blue morning sky. Also the robin flies away, because of a noise from the interior of the cave, and it perches on a thin bough that dangles loosely. Jesus goes to the entrance of his cave and crumbles some bread, calling the little birds very gently, by means of a modulated whistle, which is a very good imitation of the twittering of many birds. He then moves away, climbing higher up and resting against a rock in order not to frighten his little friends, which soon fly down. The robin being the first, and then many more of various kinds. Jesus's stillness and also his look are such that after a short time many birds are hopping only a few inches from him. I like to believe, also because of my own experience, that also the most distrustful animals go near people when their instinct tells them that they are not enemies but friends. The redbreast, which is now satisfied, flies to the top of the rock against which Jesus is leaning. It rests on a very thin branch of clematis, swings above Jesus's head, and seems to be anxious to descend upon his fair hair or his shoulder. The meal is now over. The rising sun gilds the mountaintops, and then the highest branches of the trees, whereas down below, the valley is still in the dim dawn light. The little birds, satisfied and full, fly towards the sun, and sing at the top of their voices.
"And now let us go, and wake up these other children of mine,"
says Jesus, and he walks down, as his cave is the highest one, and he enters the various caves calling the sleeping apostles by their names. Simon, Bartholomew, Philip, James, and Andrew reply at once. Matthew, Peter, and Thomas take a little longer to reply. And while Judas Thaddeus goes to meet Jesus, as soon as he sees him appear at the entrance of his grotto, as he is already ready and wide awake, the other cousin, the Iscariot, and John are fast asleep, so much so that Jesus has to shake them on their beds, made with tree branches and leaves, in order to wake them up. John, the last one to be called, is so sound asleep that he does not realize who is calling him, and in the haze of his interrupted sleep, He whispers,
"Yes, Mother, I am coming at once."
But he turns around on his other side. Jesus smiles, sits on the rustic mattress made of foliage picked in the woods. He bends and kisses the cheek of John, who opens his eyes and is dumbfounded at seeing Jesus. He sits up and says,
"Do you need me? Here I am." "No. I woke you up as I did the others. But you thought it was your mother. So I kissed you, as mothers do."
John, half naked in his under tunic, because he used his tunic and mantle as bed covers, clasps Jesus' neck and lays his head between Jesus' shoulder and cheek, saying,
"Oh, you are much more than a mother. I left her for you, but I would not leave you for her. She bore me to the earth. You are bearing me to heaven. Oh, I know what you know more than the others, what the Lord told me in this cave. See, I never came to you, and I think my companion said it was due to indifference and pride. But I am not concerned with what they think. I know that you know the truth. I was not coming to Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son of God, but to what you were in the bosom of the fire, that is the eternal love of the Most Holy Trinity. Its nature, its essence, its real essence. Oh, I cannot tell, however, what I have understood in this dark gloomy cavern that has become so full of light for me. In this cold grotto where I have been burnt by a featureless fire that has descended into the depth of my being and has inflamed me with a sweet martyrdom. In this silent cave, which has, however, sung celestial truths to me. But to what you are, the second person of the ineffable mystery, which is God, and which I penetrated because God has drawn me to himself, and I have always had him with me. And I have poured all my desires, all my tears, all my requests on your divine bosom, Word of God. Amongst the many words I have heard from you, there never was one so comprehensive as the one you told me here. You, God the Son. You, God like the Father. You, God like the Holy Spirit. You, center of the Trinity. Oh, perhaps I am blaspheming, but that is what I think. Because if you were not the love of the Father, and the love for the Father, then the love, the divine love, would be missing. And the divinity would no longer be trine, and it would lack the most becoming attribute of God, his love. Oh, I have so much in here, but it is like water gurgling against a dam, and cannot flow out. And I seem to be dying of it. So violent and sublime is the turmoil in my heart, since I have understood you. But I would not like to be freed of it for the whole world. Let me die of that love, my sweet God.
John smiles and weeps, panting, inflamed by his love, relaxing on Jesus' chest, as if he were exhausted by his ardor. And Jesus caresses him, burning with love himself. John composes himself, and with deep humility he begs,
"Do not tell the others what I told you. I am sure that they too have lived with God as I did during these past days. But leave the stone of silence on my secret."
"Do not worry, John. No one will be aware of your wedding with the love. Get dressed, come. We must leave."
Jesus goes out onto the path, where the others are already gathered. Their faces look more venerable and serene. The old ones look like patriarchs. The younger ones have a maturity and dignity which were previously concealed by their youth. The Iscariot looks at Jesus with a shy smile on his face marked by tears. Jesus caresses him passing by. Peter is silent, and his silence is so strange that it is more striking than any other change. He looks at Jesus attentively, but with a new dignity that makes his bald forehead look more spacious and his eyes more severe, whereas before they were full of gentle intelligence only. Jesus calls him near himself, and keeps him there, while waiting for John, who at last comes out. I could not say whether his face looks more pale or more flushed. It is certainly burning with a flame that does not change its color, and yet is most obvious. They all look at him.
"Come here, John, near me. And you, also, Andrew, and James of Zebedee. Then you, Simon, Bartholomew, Philip, my cousins, and Matthew. Judas of Simon here, in front of me. Thomas, come here. Sit down. I must speak to you."
They all sit down quietly, like good children, all engrossed in their internal world, and yet paying attention to Jesus, as they never did before.
"Do you know what I have done to you? You all know.
Your souls told your minds. But your souls, which were the queens these past days, have taught your minds to great virtues, humility, and silence. The son of humility and prudence, which are the daughters of charity. Only 8 days ago you would have come to proclaim your cleverness, and your new knowledge, like clever children, who are eager to astound people, and overcome their rivals. Now you are silent. You have grown from children into adolescents, and you are already aware that such a proclamation might humiliate a companion, who was perhaps less helped by God, and therefore you do not speak. You are also like pubescent girls. The holy reserve concerning the change that revealed the nuptial mystery of souls with God was born in you. These caves seemed cold, hostile, and repulsive on the first day. Now you are looking at them as if they were bright-scented nuptial rooms. You have met God in them. Before you were aware of Him, but you did not know Him in the intimacy that blends two into one. Amongst you there are some who have been married for years, some who have had but a disappointing relationship with women, some who are chaste owing to various reasons. But the chaste ones now know what perfect love is, as the married ones know. Nay, I can say that nobody knows what perfect love is, as he who is unaware of carnal lusts. Because God reveals Himself in His fullness to the pure. Both because He takes delight in giving Himself to those who are pure, as He, the most pure one, finds part of Himself in the creature free from lust. And because He wishes to compensate the creature for what it denies itself for His love. I solemnly tell you, that because of the love I have for you, and of the wisdom I possess, if I did not have to accomplish the work of the Father, I would keep you here, and be with you. Isolated, as I am sure that I would soon make great saints of you. And you would no longer be subject to confusion, defections, failures, slackening, and recurrences. But I cannot. I must go. And you must go. The world is waiting for us. The desecrated and desecrating world, which needs teachers and redeemers, is waiting for us. I wanted you to know God, so that you may love Him more than you love the world, which with all its affections is not worth one single smile of God. I wanted to make it possible for you to meditate on what the world is, and what God is, so that you may yearn for what is better. At present you are yearning only for God. Oh! I wish I could secure you in your yearning of the present moment. But the world is waiting for us. And we shall go to the world, which is waiting for us, for the sake of the holy charity, that by my order is sending you to the world, as it sent me. But I implore you, lock in your hearts, like a pearlin coffer, the treasure of the past days, in which you have examined, cured, elevated, renovated, and united yourselves to God. And keep and preserve these precious memories in your hearts, like the witness stones erected by the patriarchs in remembrance of the alliance with God. As from today you are no longer my favorite disciples, but the apostles, the chiefs of my church. All the hierarchies of the church, throughout centuries, shall descend from you, and will call you masters, having, as their master your God in His treble power, wisdom, and charity. I have not chosen you, because you are the most worthy, but for a number of reasons that you need not know now. I have chosen you in place of the shepherds who have been my disciples since I was born. Why did I do it? Because it was right to do so. Amongst you there are Galileans and Judeans, learned and unlearned, rich and poor people. And that is because of the world, that it may not say that I have chosen one category only. But you will not be sufficient for everything there is to be done. Neither now, nor later. Not all of you will remember a passage of the book. I will remind you. Book 2 of Chronicles, chapter 29, tells how Hezekiah, king of Judah, had the temple purified. And after it was purified, he had sacrifices offered in atonement, for his kingdom, for the temple, and for the whole of Judah. And then the offerings of the single individuals began. But as the priests were not sufficient for the sacrifices, the Levites, who are consecrated with a shorter rite, and the priests, were summoned. That is what I will do. You are the priests, who have been prepared by me, the Eternal Pontiff, diligently, and for a long time. But you will not suffice for the work, which is much more extensive than the sacrifice of the offerings of individuals to the Lord their God.
I will therefore associate with you the disciples who will remain such, those who are waiting for us at the foot of the mountain, those who are already higher up, those who are spread all over Israel, and that later will be spread all over the world. They will be entrusted with equal tasks, because the mission is only one, but their position will be different in the eyes of the world, but not in the eyes of God. Where there is justice, so that the obscure disciple, ignored by the apostles, and by his brethren, who lives a holy life taking souls to God, will be greater than a known apostle, who has only the name of apostle, and lowers his apostolic dignity for human purposes. The task of the apostles and disciples will still be the same as the task of the priests and Levites of Hezekiah. To perform the rites of the cult, demolish idolatries, purify hearts and places, and to preach God and His Word. There is not a more holy task on the earth. Neither is there a dignity higher than yours. That is why I said to you, listen to yourselves and examine yourselves. Woe betide the apostle who falls. He drags many disciples with him, and they drag a greater number of believers, and the ruin grows larger and larger like a falling avalanche, or a ring that expands on the lake, when several stones are thrown in the same spot. Will you all be perfect? No. Will the spirit of the present moment last? No. The world will throw its tentacles to choke your souls. That will be the victory of the world. To extinguish the light in the hearts of saints. The world, a son of Satan, for 5/10, a servant of Satan, for 3/10, indifferent to God, for the remaining 2/10. Defend yourselves from yourselves, against the world, flesh, and the demon. Above all, defend yourselves from yourselves. Stand on your guard, my children, against pride, sensuality, duplicity, stupidity, spiritual drowsiness, and against avarice. When your inferior ego speaks and moans over alleged cruelty to it, hush it up by saying, for a moment of hardship, which I give you now, I will procure for you, and forever, the banquet of ecstasy that you enjoyed in the mountain cave at the end of the month of Shabbat. Let us go. Let us go and meet the others who in large numbers are awaiting my coming. And then I will go for a few hours to Tiberias. And you, preaching me, will go to wait for me at the foot of the mountain that is on the road leading from Tiberias to the sea. I will come up there to preach. Take your bags and mantles. The retreat is over and the election has been made.
It all ends thus. May the 17th, 1945. Jesus says,
you are not feeling well and I will leave you in peace. I only wish to point out to you how a sentence omitted, or a word wrongly copied can alter everything. And you, my writer, are alive, and can make the correction at once. So consider, and try to understand how 20 centuries have deprived the gospel, the apostolic gospel, of parts that did no harm to the doctrine, but prevented it from being easily understood. This, if we go back to the origin, we find that it is still the work of disorder, explains many things, and lends itself to the children of disorder, for so many more things. And you can see how easy it is to make errors in copying. Little John, be good today. You are a broken flower. I will come later and mend your stalk. I need the tears of your wound today. God is with you.